Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Richard Price is the author of Clockers, the novel about police detectives and drug dealers. He started his career with the novel The Wanderers about street gangs in the Bronx, where he grew up. His other novels include Freedom Land, Lush Life, and Samaritan. Price adapted Clockers into a film with Spike Lee. He's written for the HBO series The Wire, written the screenplay for Sea of Love, which starred Al Pacino as a homicide detective, and the screenplay for the movie adaptation of Freedom Land. His latest book, The Whites, is a tale of a New York City police detective under siege by an unsolved murder, his own dark past, and a violent stalker out for revenge. The book is by Richard Price, writing as Harry Brandt. We'll talk about that in a moment. But before this live audience in Rhinecliff, New York, we welcome Richard Price to this week's Book Show. We're going to have you read in a few moments, and I want you to read from the book. But before you do, because I'm sure it's the question that you've been getting on the tour more than any other, is about the pseudonym.
Right.
The way it reads on the book is The Whites, Richard Price, writing as Harry Brandt.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
I needed the money. My agent said, well, you know, they're writers writing under transparent pen names. And I guess she was thinking of Benjamin Black and John Banville. I was sick of writing screenplays, you know. I said, well, I can get you a lot of money, and you could do a genre book, and you can just knock it out. If you can't do it in 4 months, it's not worth it. So I said, okay, sure. So as a defensive measure, I picked a pen name just to signal, please don't beat me up. You know, I know. But the book turned out better than I thought, and it took 4 years to write. And at the end of the day, I just felt it was a mistake. I shouldn't have used a pen name. On the other hand, I should have realized I don't write anything in 4 months. I just write at one speed, so.
So I guess I don't understand publishing enough to think that even a genre novel with your name on it wouldn't sell.
Well, if with my name on it, but that was me underestimating how much work I'd put into this book and me thinking I could write a quickie. Yeah, it was me thinking I was going to knock something out and it was going to be quick and slick and bango, bango. And it was slow and thick and not bango, bango.
From the reviews and from my, just in my reading of it and your past work and being a huge fan of your work, it seems to me it's some of your best, most beautiful writing.
So it would seem. Unbeknownst to Harry Brandt. You know. No, I just realized, you know, it's like, I only know one way to write, and it was foolish of me. I couldn't write except the way I've been writing for 41 years. I thought, okay, I'll just go into my screenplay mode, you know, and just write, you know, tight and fast and think of it as speed chess, you know. Didn't work. It just was another Richard Price book.
So let's have you read a little bit from the book, and you can set up as you're reading from close to the beginning.
Okay, well, the whites refers, it's a phrase, has nothing to do with race relations, although anything about police is always has to do with race relations. So there's a group of five detectives, four retired, and each one is obsessed with a criminal that killed people, and they caught the case, and either they could never prove it was the guy, or the guy walked away, he just skated in the courts. And they've been obsessed with this person, and they'll take this person to their grave. And even in retirement, they're still focused. And they're like Ahabs. So each cop has his individual white whale. And I made up the expression white. They're talking about their whites. Billy's the hero. He's still an active cop. His white is a guy named Curtis Taft. what Curtis Taft had done was he was dumped by a 28-year-old woman in the housing project in the Bronx. And so he gets a new girlfriend, and then he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, and he goes to the ex-girlfriend's house with a gun. He shoots and kills her. Then he shoots and kills her 14-year-old niece, who was just spending the night over there, and he shoots and kills her 4-year-old daughter. And then he just walked back to the apartment and got back in bed and went to sleep again. And everybody knew it was him, everybody, and knows it's him, but people were too scared of him to ever come forth and say, yeah, I saw him walk into the apartment. Yeah, I saw him exit the apartment. So he was never even arrested. And that's Billy's obsession, this guy. So he's at a dinner and he's talking to his friends, the other Ahabs, and he's telling them a story about what he did in his desperation to catch Curtis Taft. Can I tell you something? This is Billy Graves talking. Can I tell you something? You talk about exorcisms. I never told this to anybody before because it embarrassed me. But about 6 months into trying to nail Curtis Taft, my wife convinced me to consult a psychic. Get out, Jimmy Whalen said. Yeah, some old Italian lady upstate in Brewster. I mean, I was so desperate at that point. So I call her up, go to her house. I swear to God, she looked just like Casey Stengel. I go in, hey, how you doing? Thanks for seeing me. I walk into the living room. The walls are covered with appreciation letters from different police departments around the country. Maybe a few from Canada, another from Germany. It was pretty impressive until you go up close and read one. It has come to my attention that you might possibly have been of some assistance in the as yet unsolved homicide death of fill in the blank. Thank you for your enthusiasm. Sincerely, Elmo Butkus, Chief of Police, French Kiss in Idaho. But whatever, I'm there. I sit on the couch. She's in a rocking chair. I was told to bring some objects belonging to the victims. So I hand over a barrette belonging to the 4-year-old. Then I give in the 14-year-old's iPod and Tanya Howard's Bible. Tanya Howard is the girlfriend that dumped the killer. I tell the psychic what we think happens. Taft coming in there around sunrise, 3 shots and just walking out, going home, getting back in bed with his still asleep girlfriend. She says to me, okay, here's how it works. I'm going to sit here and think about what you just told me, and I'm going to get a little worked up. And I'll say things, a word, a phrase. You write everything down, whatever I say. And then she says, now the things I'll be saying, I don't know what any of it means. They're like pieces of a puzzle that you got to put together, okay? You're the detective, not me, okay? Okay. And I'll wait, she says. By the way, I never charge cops for helping them. That's my civic duty. All I ask in return is a letter from you on your police department stationery thanking me for my assistance. I say, you got it. Let's go. And then she starts rocking in her chair, rubbing the 4-year-old's barrette and lets it rip. 4 years old, that poor little kid. She never had a chance. She'll never see her mother again or play jump rope. That evil, that's butter. And I almost jumped out the window. She shouted it so loud, but I write it down, butter. And then she's off again. What kind of cold-blooded dude would take the life of running water? Okay, write it down, running water. I mean, everything in the world is near running water, a river, a sink, a sewer. I mean, are you serious? Then she starts going on about the 14-year-old. Young teenage girl, her whole damn life in front of her, this vicious pig, this miserable piece of tires. Okay, tires, there's a billion cars out there. He snuffs the life out of 3 young ladies, and then what does he do? He goes home and crawls back in bed with his new girlfriend like he just got up to take a leak. Can you imagine what a piece of work that stupid broken toilet? And I swear on my children, when she said that broken toilet, I just about fell out of my chair. Listen to me. The bodies were discovered by Tanya Howard's new boyfriend when he came back from work about 5-6 hours later. And by the time we got there, rigor was going pretty good. We found the 14-year-old and Tanya in the living room, and we thought that was it. But when I opened the bathroom door, Billy stopped and wiped his dry mouth. See, when Curtis Taft lived with Tanya, whenever he would discipline the little one, he'd always take her into the bathroom, and that's where he took her to shoot her that morning. And after he shot her, he stuck her head and shoulders in the toilet. Like I said, rigor had set in, and we couldn't get her out, so we had to use a sledgehammer to shatter the porcelain. So broken toilet, the lady says. Don't ask me how. Then what happened? I brought her back to the projects and let her into the apartment, see if she could maybe pick something up in the air. Did she? Nope. What did she say when she saw the broken toilet? just nodded like, I told you so. She got you on the running water tube, Waylon said. If you want to get technical about it. That too, I guess, Billy said. You write a vet letter? I'm working on it.
Richard Price reading from his new novel.
And you should know how many curse words I took out and what a great effort that was.
He said he was going to edit on the fly. He did a great job. Amazing. You just mentioned two things before you started reading that I wanted to ask you about. One, you explained the whites, but then you said basically whenever you're talking about cops, you're talking about race.
The majority of poor people, especially in urban areas, are non-white. The police, that's the customers. And as discussed, I forgot the guy's name. I think it was Michael Harrington who wrote a book called The Other America about poverty in 1960. And he said in poor neighborhoods, police are always seen as the occupying army. The police feel like they're outnumbered, overwhelmed, and they got to show force. If you don't show force, you know, you'll get run over. So they're always going to be a little more proactive to try to maintain control being a minority. I'm not anti-police. I'm not pro-police, you know. It's hard to be anti-poor people, so I don't even have to go there. But I've been in situations with cops during the crack era. You're in a housing project, and you're a housing cop with a bunch of cops, and you see a black teenager running fast. You don't know what he's running from. And they think, did he just rob somebody? And they think the worst because it's survival of the quickest thinking. He might be running home because he's late for dinner because there was a fight or he shot somebody. They will always assume a running black kid, let's just pat him down. And so they'll stop. I saw them stop kids and, you know, just strip them down to their underwear in the street, just pat them down. This is during the crack era and there's a lot of stuff going on. And this kid was saying, you know, I go to community college because the cop understands if you let somebody mouth off on you in front of other people, you lose ground with these people. You're going to be out here every night. And if they see you, and this kid knows that he just has to go along with it. And his head's like boiling with rage or steam. And he has to put on one face for them. And the cops are thinking, look, I don't know if the kid did anything, but in case he did, I'm going to do my job. I'm going to, you know, I'll apologize afterwards, in some kind of curt way, but there's no way I'm going to let a running black kid run. And I can give you examples from the cops' point of view. It's an occupying army. Everybody's afraid of losing face and ground in a situation like that.
You mentioned that you started writing this 4 years ago, so obviously the latest chapter that we as a society are dealing with in Ferguson and even the tragic incident in New York City. So your book comes out in that environment and seems so obviously so relevant. And I guess the point is that it probably always will be in some way.
My book has nothing really to do with that, you know, that type of encounter.
Right.
If I was writing about Ferguson or using Ferguson as a starter's yeast for, you know, like one of my doorstopper books, I never would have thought to use a pen name, because that's a book where I'm really addressing something, like looking for a crime that epitomizes some basic crisis in American life. So that would have been a different book.
But you are writing about cops.
Yes. My reaction to what happened in Ferguson and what happened to Eric Garner and shooting the 12-year-old kid in Cleveland and all the other things that are popping up. These things have been going on since the founding of the country. The big difference is somebody took a cell phone out, and the ability of instant media to make it a world event. Listen, I mean, look at the Arab Spring, what happened there. Are you kidding? Cops put a beat on a guy, and there's five cell phones on the street. You know, it's going to be everywhere. So these things have been going on since time immemorial. Can you imagine what they were doing in 1950 in Los Angeles, 1930 in Harlem? It's the advent of the cell phone that makes it seem like brand new, and it's a plague, but it's always been a plague. we just haven't seen it intimately. What we don't see, like, it's like eating a hamburger and not thinking about how they killed the cow and cut him up. You know, so we hear about police racism or police brutality or this and that, but now you see it, and all of a sudden everybody's a vegan. It's just the immediacy of the internet.
It's safe to say, certainly in reading this book and throughout your writing, both as a screenwriter and as a fiction writer, that you understand cops.
Well, I grew up in a working class housing project. Anybody of my age who didn't go to college either worked in a union, went into the military, or became a cop. So it's like I grew up with these guys. There's a big difference between understanding people and being an advocate for these people.
Right.
I mean, what I learned about cops, and I say this all the time, is that once I discovered going around with cops, I could see so much more of the world, because I would go to places where human behavior was in such extremis that police presence is required. I could go into places I would never go into on my own, and I would meet the people. And when the cops were finished with their business, the next day I was back and talking to the people that, in sort of an ironic way, I was introduced to by the cops. They were just my entry into the world. When I'm running with them, I'm grateful that they took me in and taking me along. But it's not like being psychologically embedded with the troops and then you just write about the good soldier or something like that. They took me in and I'm grateful for that. I will witness and I will write what I see, but it won't pass judgment. I'll do the same for the other side of the fence. Grateful for being taken in. I'll write what I see. I'll bear witness. I'll show both sides through my eyes without telling people what to think, who to root for, who's the bad guy. Invariably, it'll be so gray as opposed to black and white. And it's up to the reader to say, well, the problem is this. And if the reader wants to come down and read the book, like, well, yeah, a policeman's lot is difficult, or it's an outrage, you know, what these cops do. You know, I'm not going to editorialize. Now, saying that, I'm a writer. I'm in the back of a cop car. I'm getting hammered with cops. I'm a writer, and they know that. So I don't know what they're like when I'm not around. I mean, they're going to save a lot of stuff, you know, for when they're with their own tribe, you know, with no missionary there. And same thing, you know, the people in the projects, you know, the drug dealers or the people that are just straight families trying to get through, you know, a hard time in a hard place, they have a guest and they're going to be a certain way. And there's a duality with both sides.
You spoke a moment ago about bearing witness. In that bearing witness that you, I believe you often describe it just as hanging out with these mm-hmm. with these guys, that not just cops, but in any situation. So if you want to know what a pool hall scene is like, mm-hmm. then you go to the pool hall and you hang out.
And what you see, when you go to a pool hall, you don't focus on the game. You don't focus on this pool hustler's mastery of the game. You focus on the non sequiturs. You focus on the visual non sequiturs, overheard things. You're always looking for chips off the periphery that will metastasize into a whole world. Anybody can go write an instruction manual about playing pool and the life of the pool hustler. Somebody once said sometimes when they go to a symphony, yes, there's the music and it's great, but then people get distracted. Why is that French horn player blowing so much spit out of his horn? It's like, that's an awful lot of spit. What's up with this guy? You know, I kind of look for the spit valve in everything, so.
That's a beautiful way of describing it, Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to go down to G's Ben and have somebody quilt that saying into a...
Is that why it can often, why you can't write something in 4 months, of why it takes 4 years? Because there is that waiting for it.
No, if I stay, here's what happens. I have a plot. Okay, I got the whole plot. Then you actually start writing. And this character that you thought you were going to keep thin for speed is a character that's starting to inhabit you, and you're discovering history for that character, nuances. And the characters, instead of being greyhounds, become bull mastiffs. And in the act of writing, all bets are off. You know, you can plan up the wazoo, but once I'm writing, I realize, no, this character wouldn't do this. He'd do that. And you know why he'd do that? Because he had a mother, or, you know, when he was a kid, or when he was in college, you know, all of a sudden I'm spinning this wild CV for this guy. I thought, okay, he's going to be a hero. And then all of a sudden he's a mess of a hero. Okay, here's your villain. But how did he get to be a villain? Next thing I know, it's 4 years.
So you've ended up with more than a genre novel, and yet you say that it's, you know, it's not the normal, it's not the book stop or the doorstop that perhaps
no
you would have written in the past.
No, because in the past, like I said, if I write, and I don't consider myself a crime writer, but when I do these big broad books, I look for an event that will essentialize what's going on in that amorphous vast area. And if it's a crime, I can follow a police investigation because it's orderly and chronological and pull in all these people from different parts of the world. But it's usually inspired because there's been an event. So if I didn't have any of that for The Whites, I really wanted to write something thin, and what you see is what you get. As you turn the page, you want to get to the next page. It's about the characters. It's not about a bigger issue.
Although it does say a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah. If, you know, I just wonder, because people always ask me about Ferguson and Eric Garner, but that happened way after I wrote the book.
Right.
But given the history of what I write about, it's natural that people would ask me. But, you know, 99% of the time, I read the papers. That's how I get my information. You know, I watch the TV, you know, news, and that's how I get my information. But people would tend, because of what I write about, to think I'm an expert on this thing. And so I try to be an expert, but I'm not.
You probably answered this already, but just by saying that it takes 4 years and that you can't do them quickly, but would you want to write a series?
A series? I'm 65 years old. I don't know if I got time to write a series of anything. Maybe a series of monographs. But then again, that'll take 4 years, given my MO. I would love to return to these characters. I owe a book to Farrar Straus, another publisher, that I'm going to write next. But if for nothing else, I would like to continue with the people in this book, because it's better, so much better. All I want to do is write books, all I ever want to do. I have the good luck and the curse to write screenplays and TV pilots, and that's what pays the bills. But if I could figure out a way to make an equal amount of money, where even the stuff I don't want to do is writing books, that would be heaven. And I'm dying to go back to The Whites. I think I'll call the next one The Chartreuses.
Richard Price's latest is The Whites. It is published by Holt. Richard Price, what a great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. This special edition was recorded at the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff, New York, in partnership with Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck and Millerton, New York, oblongbooks.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
Repetition. Composition. Mirrors.
Most of all, the world is a place where parts of holes are described within an overarching paradigm of clarity and accuracy, the context of which makes possible an underlying sense of the way it all fits together, despite our collective tendency not to conceive of it as such. But then again, the world without end is a place where souls are combined. With an overbearing feeling of disparity, disorderliness. To ignore it is impossible without getting oneself in all kinds of trouble, despite one's best intentions not to get entangled with it so much. Meanwhile, statues are bleeding green, and others are saying things much better than we ever could, as the quiet suddenly verbose, and the hell is hell.
sides of nickels. And the street corners are gnashing together like a gears inside of the head of some omniscient engineer. Downward flows the garnered wisdom that has never.